will end up by drowning in the mud of egotism or getting lost in the treacherous labyrinth of ignorance if you do not react in time. As I have already told you, man will soon reach other worlds, and the only thing you can export to them is depredation, ambition and greed. As well, your scientists are approaching the discovery of secrets that will unravel the mysteries of traveling through space and through time. In the hands of beings that are not lost inside themselves, this knowledge would be a terrible risk to the stability of other humanities as well as to the natural continuation of this universe. None of our extraplanetary societies are interested in a relationship with what the human race represents at this moment. Just the contrary, for man is an immature creature as well as dangerously unpredictable. We sincerely hope this picture will change for the well-being and harmony of this solar system and the whole universe. You can accomplish this change and much more. If you accept, we will help you. Those words were very serious and weighty for a bunch of kids. After days of little sleep and much thought, Sixto, Juan, Mito, Enrique and I finally decided to accept and continue. We believed that Amta was quite right and that this was a unique opportunity. There were a lot of things to learn and a lot to accomplish. Our group fervently wished that man could improve his life and that somehow, violence, hunger and misery would stop afflicting humanity. And if it was somehow possible to cooperate in this transformation, we would do our utmost to make it happen. Sixto, myself and the others in the group that had had that unusual physical encounter held a meeting with all the participants of the contact activities to tell them what had transpired. We discussed whether the activities should be continued and told them in detail of the offer that the guides had made. For several hours, the group discussed all the implications of agreeing and finally unanimously decided to accept the extraterrestrials' offer. We were bursting with happiness at the thought of resuming our work again and of what would come of it. We laughed and joked over what lay ahead of us, but finally I drew their attention to the seriousness of our commitment and asked them for a minute of silence. The extension and responsibility of that moment had totally escaped our perception. Only afterwards did we decide to communicate with the guides in order to tell them of our decision and wait for their response. Juan pointed out that we were beginning a new phase in our relationship with our guides. What we would have to face in the future would probably not be easy. So we agreed on a commitment to stand together, come what may. The feeling that something very special was going to happen was shared by all. It was a magical moment. We re-established communications and the guides set another field outing for July 6. It was a general convocation. Everybody who took part in the contact group should be present, including my mother, Mochi. As usual, Sixto and I, Juan and a few others arrived earlier than our appointment, not only to have more time to organize things, but also to check that everything was all right at our meeting place. Mine was situated near a police customs post on the South Pan American Highway, and we might have any kind of unpleasant surprise or undesirable visitor, so we had adopted the habit of checking the area before an encounter. This time it was not different. We arrived a few hours in advance. Well equipped and already used to the journey, we started walking to the usual place, the mine. On the way we remembered the time when Sixto disappeared suddenly from the group without warning. We remembered how curious it had been and how different from the time of Oak's projection, when the strange interdimensional door was seen. It was already night and we had reached the place when Juan called our attention to three circles of light on the ground in front of us. The lights came from the ground with no apparent source of projection. They were perfectly circular and equidistant, forming a perfect triangle. Telepathically, Parker received the message that we should all stand inside the circles, which we did immediately. Although it was tight, for I remember well there were seven of us, we maneuvered ourselves so that everybody could stand inside them. Slowly, a strange sensation took hold of us while a kind of bright mist formed around us. It was like bluish smoke that sent off a fluorescent light with strobe effects. I could not quite understand what was going on. For the first time, we were surrounded by that strange mist and something was happening to us. There was a different odor in the air, like the perfume of roses. I felt very dizzy. Suddenly, everything stopped and the mist vanished as quickly as it had come. We could hear nothing but the silence of the night and the squeaking of the bats. The night was as calm as when we had first arrived. We looked at each other in astonishment. It took us a few minutes before we could speak again. We exchanged impressions on what we had felt, and realized that we had all experienced the same sensations. At that moment we saw the headlights of cars approaching at a distance. Still a little agitated over what had happened, we welcomed our companions. Parker excitedly told all the others what we had just experienced. They listened attentively, and at the end of the narrative they all agreed that it must have been Asin. The group completed the last part of the journey on foot, talking about the incident. It was quite a large group that day, around 20 to 25. After some time I noticed that Sixto was not near us. Immediately I remembered the time when he had been transported to a place away from the group. I hurried to find him among the other participants. Marina, his girlfriend at the time and his wife now, had already been looking for him for some time. We went on searching together. When we walked behind some dunes, we saw Sixto between two hills and ran to him. We were surprised to see that Azendra had opened again and Oksk was in front of it. Marina, fearing her boyfriend would be taken from this planet, ran towards him shouting hysterically. I stayed behind, frozen, staring at the scene. Oksk noticed Marina's presence and she was suddenly lifted into the air almost 2 meters above the ground. Sixto was frightened and did not know what to do. Marina was pale, paralyzed with fear. I did not know whether I should go and call the others or run towards the two. A few seconds later, the girl was put down on the ground. This time she stayed where she was. Sixto ran to her and held her. Then Oksk insistently signaled Sixto to follow him. Sixto let go of Marina but was reluctant. Mentally he felt that the guide was summoning him, but in his heart he refused to comply. I could sense my brother's indecision and began to approach slowly in case he needed me. A few meters from Oksk, I stopped and watched. Visibly frightened, Sixto was in a cold sweat and his heartbeat had accelerated. He could not move a finger or take a step. In that absurd mental chaos, a word was insistently repeated in his mind, "Come." He knew that Oksk was calling him. My brother tried to master his fear and reason. He was being called to enter Azendra alone and the possibility frightened him. The ignorance of what might happen mixed with images of dozens of science fiction films that we had seen when we were kids. There is unique, absolute, universal reality, elements and facts that escape any intelligence for the reason that they are physically far apart in different points of the universe, but also situated and participant in innumerable manifestations of matter. Either visible or invisible, these facts, these elements are there to be understood, for they hide the secret of the profound in themselves. It is as if creation plays hide and seek with the thinking being, continuously challenging him to discover where the creator is. The same as there are facts and elements forming the cosmos itself, there is an explanation for all this. This is the absolute truth. There is an absolute answer to absolute facts. For every reality to be discovered there is a truth to explain it. No matter where in the cosmos, a galaxy or a world, an atom will always be an atom. Remember that two units will always be two units anywhere, the only difference will be the symbols used to identify the units. The basic concepts, the values that form a perspective of life applied to daily life and to interpersonal or environmental relationships are what basically differentiate the ones who are evolving from the ones who aren't. As I have already mentioned, along his evolutionary journey the thinking being meets situations that must be understood and assimilated to ease, else hinder, his progress. Certain situations will be understood and assimilated with more or less clarity than others. This is where distortion comes in. When several people are investigating a fact and they don't coincide in their explanation, it means something is wrong. The one who is the most attentive will have to point out the misunderstanding, but this will only be possible if the others are ready to realize their immediate position, their commitment to the objective to be reached. When facing the same situation, each person offers a different interpretation. It's better to stop and consider each one's standpoint in life because it's very easy to ignore. There can be no intransigence whatsoever in evolution. Life doesn't depend on individuality to be accomplished, it depends on solidarity. In short, Charlie, we can define three types of truth. One is the absolute truth or the complete explanation of the reason for creation and the interactions that preserve it. Another is the truth referred to in your world as individual truths, those deriving from a partial experience of life that interprets everything and formalizes the conclusion with an irrefutable dogma. Besides being false and distorted, this truth is also limited by time and by the dynamics of information, because knowledge and information flow very swiftly and you never stop learning. What is known as a rule today will be superseded by a new discovery tomorrow. In this existence, nothing is rigid or eternal, everything will be replaced, everything changes, and everything is transformed. But this closed, individual, egotistical, self-sufficient way to relate to the universe hinders the continuity of existence, it endangers the present and future life of all creatures around him, as well. The third and most important truth is the one we call temporary. But this one derives from a more developed society with all the components sharing the same information and knowledge. Although the knowledge, the understanding and the information are not equally great in everybody's mind, the basic notions are the same and the perception of the truth and reality is shared and complemented by all the members, so they all have an ample vision, although still incomplete according to the evolutionary, historical moment in which the group lives. They are fully conscious of this natural condition. So, there is an absolute total truth, removed from any developing creature, for you would have to become God to have it. However, there is the temporary one that allows a society to progress rapidly as long as they are all interdependent participants of the acquired knowledge, never tied to dogmas or rigid principles, flexible in their changes and dynamic in their development. Individuality, that is, the condition of being one within a group, serves as a complement, not as an obstacle. There are no individual interests, only collective ones. The development of the group is the objective, and as a consequence the progress of the individual will occur. A satisfied society means a satisfied, secure, confident, motivated individual. A society divided in individual feuds of private, unilateral truths whose existential reality obeys only the desire to continue living at any cost is a society condemned to destruction, because its members are all competitors and enemies. Charlie, I feel sorry for humankind, for man believes he has the right to judge everything and everybody, he considers himself an expert in identifying what he needs to live well and what is bad for his continuity. But he is proponent, arrogant and despises any real opportunities to progress. He is blind, dazzled by the light of his ego, and is deaf to the thunder of his egocentric individualism. We wish to reach your heart and that of every human being to show you the road you left because you were too distracted, worrying about survival and defending yourselves from the others. Every man can attain the state of freedom. Freedom to live. Freedom to love and be loved. Freedom to learn and teach. Freedom to suffer and be happy. Although part of the guilt of its present is in the genetics of its origin, your world went willingly astray. The easiest way is always that of inertia. Any other implying harder work, sacrifice, is always left aside. Correction and change is as difficult as finding the mistake. But the moment has come. We can't goon like silent spectators, watching a species destroy itself day by day, in a slow agony that could be avoided. We know there are many like you that can be rescued and taught to go back to a worthy, productive, satisfactory way of life. The means to transcend this moment is in your hands and in all of those who want to build a new view of life. We need you to be the intermediary between us. We want you to gather these people so that we can together make your hope come true." After that, the guide stood up and asked me to follow him. I was still perplexed by what I had heard, and I had a terrible headache. I could hardly think. We continued towards the square where the busts in the fountain had impressed me so much. When we got near the place, I sent out a thought related to the bust that looked like a human at the top of the group of sculptures. Goda looked at me immediately and stopped walking. I could see that my curiosity was not well accepted, but I could not stand the doubt and asked directly, "Goda, who is that man that has deserved to stand in the square together with the other sculptures in the fountain? Is he human? From Earth?" The guide was silent, and without answering went on walking towards a huge building behind the ones in the square of the sculptures. A little annoyed with his silence, I followed, or tried to follow, my guide's steps. Finally, we got to the doors of a gigantic building. It was a rectangular construction with curved corners. There were columns on both sides forming an arc up to the top of the building that was about 20 stories tall. Huge doors of more than 5 meters in height opened to let us through, and I could see an enormous hall as large as a sports gymnasium. There was a row of about 20 couches. They had an anatomical shape and a kind of cupola on top of it that seemed to be made of dark red acrylic. The couch was made of padded plastic. Each couch was suspended in the air, 1.5 meters high, floating over a luminous net fixed on the floor. In front of each couch was a wall with a screen of 4 by 2 meters. The hall was about 15 meters high and at least 30 meters wide. Other beings similar to Goda walked from one place to other, carrying strange devices that were deposited beside each couch. Then I felt afraid. Goda took me to one of the couches and asked me to lie down. My fear grew greater. I felt totally defenseless. I did not know whether I should run or stay. Nothing had been done against my will so far. They had always sought my agreement. But even so, I felt afraid at that moment. Noticing my reluctance, the guide said that if I lay down I could recover from my headache and then go back to Earth. He said that I should not fear anything, for all they wanted was to help me overcome my physical exhaustion caused by the journey and all that had happened. My anxiety eased, but my headache was still very strong. Tired out by all the adventure, I agreed and lay down. The couch gave way a little under my weight. It felt like an air mattress. It was extremely comfortable, and I accommodated myself in it. Then the screen in front of me began to show an image, but I lost consciousness. Suddenly I woke up, jumped up and sat on the couch. Goda was beside me and everything seemed perfectly calm. I felt well. My headache had completely disappeared. Then I looked at my watch for the first time and saw that 6 hours had gone by since I had arrived at the city through the Zendra. Surprised, I stood up, thinking that all my friends and my brother would be worried about me and had probably already returned to Lima, leaving me alone in the middle of the desert. Goda signaled me to follow him, but this time I was the one to go fast. On the way I began to plan things in case everybody had left for Lima. I was thinking of perhaps going to Donna Mora's house in Papalion, which was not far from the contact area, and from the looking for a bus or waiting until dawn. Goda stopped at the same spot where he had met me at my arrival. I hastily thanked him for all I had learned, promising to make good use of every word I had heard. Goda smiled and waved his right hand. I gave back a sad smile, for I did not know when I would have another opportunity to see him. Behind me the dimensional door opened. I held my knapsack firmly and stepped inside. Again, the bright mist surrounded me. The sensation of a strange coldness, the burning on my skin and an uncomfortable queasiness made it difficult to think. But in a few seconds, I was at the top of the hill in Chilka again, exactly where my journey had begun. It was night, so I looked for my flashlight. Then I looked at my watch and saw something that shocked me and made my legs tremble. Weak with the shock, I sat down on the sand. Although more than 6 hours had passed as I had noticed when I was with Goda, The calendar of my watch showed a difference of 15 days from the date when I had entered the Zendra. In other words, I had stayed 15 days and 6 hours in Alpha Centauri, but had only 6 hours conscious time. The rest of the time I had been totally unconscious, but why? Automatically, I raised my hand to my face and noticed my beard, although very short at the time, had grown a little. I turned my thoughts to establishing how I would get back to Lima so late at night and how to make my way out of the middle of the desert. As I walked down the hill, I remembered that I should not worry because the extraterrestrial had probably told my friends of my stay in Alpha Centauri. So they might be waiting for me. Otherwise, Donna Marucha would have an unexpected guest for that night. Going round the hill, I saw in the distance the gleam of flashlights and the headlights of our vehicles where we usually met. I was relieved to see that I could go back to Lima comfortably. I continued walking more easily now, but I could not get that sculptured face in the fountain in the bust square out of my mind. I wondered who it was. A few minutes later I reached the parked vehicles. I was glad to meet everybody, but nobody paid any attention to my presence. Astonished at such disregard, I went to my brother and asked how they had known the right day to come and meet me. My brother looked at me, puzzled. "What do you mean, come and meet you? You went up that hill 15 minutes ago. What are you talking about?" Right then, my sister Rose came up, excited. "What happened? Did you give up on meeting Goda? Are you all right? Why did you come back so quickly?" I was completely puzzled. Was I mad? I checked the day and the time and confirmed that we had all arrived at the mine 30 minutes before. This was crazy. I had spent 15 days and 6 hours in another world and had been sent back 15 days, 5 hours and 45 minutes before. If I understood it correctly, at that exact moment, I coexisted simultaneously in two places at the same time. I had traveled through time. I had come back to the past. Although only 15 minutes had gone by on Earth, I was 15 days, 5 hours and 45 minutes older. I would have other crazy adventures like that one. In the following days, I was more and more curious about the sculpture in the bust square. I did not know at that time that I would soon come across some information about that character, and that later on I would learn what had happened to me during those 15 days. My life had turned into the remarkable adventure. Chapter 20. Brazil, the Great Laboratory. On Thursday, February 19, 1976, after my first experience of flying in an airplane, we landed at the International Airport of Varacious in São Paulo. Although the flight was originally due to land in Congonhas in the center of São Paulo, a delay in the connection and change of planes in Brasilia caused the substitution of airports. My uncle Leon, Aunt Rosa's Chilean husband, came to meet me with a young man from Arequipa called José Quino Pedes, better known as Peep. Peep was another student that I had met during the selection process at the Brazilian embassy who had applied for a vacancy in architecture at Mackenzie University. Ash would be on his own without any relatives in the city. I had given him my aunt and uncle's address in case he needed any help, and they had become good friends. I could not speak a word of Portuguese. I felt nervous as I took my first steps in a strange land that would become the country of my new life. After the usual proceedings through customs, we took the highway to São Paulo. While we were talking, my uncle drew my attention to a bright light in the sky that split into two luminous objects speeding toward the clouds. I said they might be two extraterrestrial lights. My uncle did not reply. "They seem to be welcoming me," I thought, while my uncle and Peep wondered what it might be. A few hours later, we arrived at the cosmopolitan megacity of São Paulo. How big it was! I felt so provincial and lost in that huge monstrosity of concrete and asphalt. My relatives lived in a wonderful flat on Alameda Franca at the corner of 9 of July Avenue. My Aunt Rose and my cousin Pamela were not home, they were away on a trip to Argentina. I had a terrible first night, dreaming that I was still in Lima and planning things that I could not do when I woke up the following day. During the first weeks, I went out with Peep to visit the city and learn how to get around. Sweet Lucienne and her mother, who were my Aunt Rosa's and Pamela's friends, helped us greatly with our efforts at familiarization. On March 8, 1976, my course at the University of São Paulo started, my first class being statistics. It was almost terrible, frightening thing to face a teacher, to see him speak and write on the blackboard, and be unable to understand a single word. So the first weeks at the university presented me with a great challenge. But willpower and a good dose of determination can solve many things. At that time, I was so busy trying to quickly learn Portuguese that it did not occur to me to think of forming a group or telling people about the extraterrestrial contacts. However, thanks to my cousin Pamela, things would change. During her stay in Lima, my cousin had dated my good friend Rodolfo and had taken part in several field outings and seen a few extraterrestrial spaceships. Pamela and her friends, including Luciana, usually met in a snack bar called La Rira's on Pamplona Street. One day, Pamela told her friends Paulo, Marco Antonio or Pitoco, Diego, Rui, Bacal and Lucien about contact activities in Peru and the experiences we had had with the extraterrestrials. Of course, it was not so easy for them to accept what Pamela told them, so one day when I came back from university, I found all those youngsters in the living room of the house, waiting for me. They wanted to learn about the extraterrestrial guides and I saw an opportunity to form my first group. They were all good kids with a healthy curiosity, between 15 and 18 years old, an excellent public with which to begin any work. Little by little, I explained everything we that had transpired in Peru. After a few weeks we had our first field outing. I had received references for a meeting place, but as I was not used to the geography of the state of São Paulo, the kids had to unscramble the message for me. The appointed place was the distant Jacuí Beach in the northern region of São Paulo, between Bixioga and São Sebastião. The problem was how to get there. Bacal had borrowed a car, an old Landon, perfect for that trip. Armed with firm determination we went to the beach. The drive was horrible, for there was no highway at that time, only an earthen track. When we got there, we had to look for protection from the rain in an old boat shelter. There, looking at the sea, I received the message that the rain would stop in 5 minutes and that a spaceship would come to confirm our first contact in Brazil. And so it did. After 5 minutes the rain stopped completely, and a disc-shaped object came out of the sea a few kilometers in front of us. It was a wonderful spectacle. Everybody was frozen, not knowing what to make of things. A different world was opening up for them. A reality as paradoxical as life itself. During the following weeks, the group began to develop communication, which allowed for new field outings and an increased number of experiences. Meanwhile, my Portuguese was slowly getting better. The continuous exchanges with the group and the necessities of my studies forced me to make desperate efforts to be understood, and I finally got rid of the deplorable Portinhol, a mixture of Portuguese and Spanish. One day, talking to some of my friends in the psychology course, I touched on the subject of extraterrestrial contact, which raised a heated polemic. Tania and Claudio invited me to lunch, where I met Carlos, Tania's husband, an engineer greatly interested in that subject. Tania and Carlos had gone through a strange experience during a drive back to São Paulo, when they lost the notion of time for several kilometers. They had been headed in a certain direction, but had come out in a completely different one without having taken any side road or roundabout at any time. Gradually, other people joined the group. Tania, Carlos, Claudio, Milton, Fernando Eugenio and Jaime also joined in. It was through Jaime that I met the renowned researcher and Brazilian pioneer in the field of UFO phenomenon investigation, Professor Flavio Pereira, who invited me to participate many times as a guest on his television program called Intelligence on TV Gazeta Channel 11.